Let us take nothing for granted, not the water coming out of the faucet, nor the smell of bread, nor the call of the lone crow overhead late in the afternoon. Do not take for granted the shoestring that does its job every day without complaint, nor the way the fingernail clipper responds when asked by squeezing thumb and forefinger, nor dark roast, nor the smell of its brewing, nor chocolate, especially chocolate, nor the leaf pasted upon the windshield, its puckered body yellow, its spidery vein green, which even the wiper cannot remove. Especially do not take the venality of those in power for granted, nor the callousness of those intent upon teaching a lesson to someone else which they have not learned themselves. Instead, be taken aback. Don't take your indignity for granted either. Your indignity at the hunger of the poor. Don't take indignity in the sense of the privilege to mistake their position for their worth. Don't take for granted the drums of war. Don't assume inevitability, for at this moment, as Ed Stuyvesant said, all things are still evitable. And we do not know what there will be an outbreak of. Instead, embrace surprise, for in our surprise, we embody the possibility of something else. In our surprise, we remind the world of what it might be. The trick is to take the moment out of the picture frame or the cardboard box or the digital bite or the philosophical system, the equating of this for that, the alchemy of life into metaphor, when nothing equates with anything exactly. And it's the space between where we think something fits and what the fitting leaves out, where life breathes. Refuse boredom. Don't let the ever-continuing recombination of genetic material blind you to the beauty of its expression. When we take nothing for granted, we will appear a little daft. Apparently obtuse and dull-witted, as if we are only noticing something for the first time, which everybody else has known since the day before the first day of junior high, the last day to learn something before you were pilloried for your ignorance. When we take nothing for granted, people will be embarrassed for us and for themselves. So let us be masters of the obvious, masters of the wisdom that everyone already holds but appears to have forgotten because they don't name it, and in not naming it, lose it. Let us be known for saying, "The sun came up this morning. The sky is blue, the leaves are turning color, this food tastes good. Someone emptied the dishwasher. There's gas in the car. This system is unjust. Things will change. You are my friend." Let us be masters of the repeated affirmation, masters of the redundancy of affection, giving more gifts than necessary in the knowledge that the slippage in the universe requires us to give more than we should have to give, over and over. So let us be masters of appearing foolish, masters of the obvious insight, masters of what is already known, only to be found again and again and again, and delighted in each time at its discovery. Let us take nothing for granted, especially this moment here before us. Here we are, 40-something years down the road. And Steve Sanfield wrote a poem about this very moment many years ago. He didn't know it was about this moment, but it was. 3 days out, 2 flat tires, busted oil pan, broken axle, so far, so good. It's on my refrigerator. It's my whole life. I started writing this talk 2 or 3 weeks ago, and every time I kept writing, I said, "I'm not going to say that. What am I going to do? What am I going to do?" And I just had this really horrible realization this morning, which is I gave a TED talk in April, and the whole TED talk was about you've got to tell a story when you're talking. You have to tell a story. And I finished the speech, and it's 80 million pages long, and there's no stories in it. But I just said to somebody, well, there's a difference between what's written here and what I'm going to say. So, you know, Gregory Bateson said about this apocryphal story about these computer guys who developed a computer that worked like the human mind. See, I'm already off text. This is so great. And he asked they tested it by asking, how does a human mind work? And the computer responded, that reminds me of a story. So here we go. Wouldn't it be nice if we could close this conference all green on the five things that we should do to help storytelling? And actually, you know, if we could do that, it would be amazing because those things would probably happen. But all of us here are problem children. So we're just going to have to agree on some things and disagree on others and head off with the plan to do just the best we can. I always said, you know, the 12 Habits of Effective, you know, that book is just enough to give you diarrhea. And I'm always interested in the 3 habits of people who do what they can. So but the problem is, one of these inconvenient truths about this storytelling event, this 40-year experiment, is that storytelling is really not about the romantic notion of storytelling or storytelling as a concept, but it's about flesh and blood people who call themselves storytellers. And they are almost by definition anarchists or lone wolves. They spend entirely too much time by themselves. They stand on stage alone. They write alone. They practice alone. They sit in airplanes and cars alone, and after everyone else in the theater has gone, they're still there, and they go home alone. At least they probably should. We hope they do. And this approach to life makes it inherently difficult for us to organize and as a group think about what's best about our art and what we do. If we didn't think we were the one who were the most important thing, we would have found some other thing else. I've just often been amazed at the hubris it requires to say, actually, you 300 people in the room need to pay attention to me at this moment. It's just a ridiculous, and I'm so happy you're doing it. So we don't have to act as one, but it would be nice if we could at least talk about things, which is, of course, what NSN is here. And actually, I want to say this before. I know the talk yesterday at the meeting about the finances, it looks really good, but it's not good enough. So when I go home, I'm going to write a check for NSN, and we should, okay, we need to do more. But making this all worse, is this anarchist, is that we're all mongrels. We are none of us is pure. We're refugees from theater and the world of oral tradition and libraries and schools of education and the world of music and dance and academia and welfare and the corporate world. None of us here are pure. All of us are mongrels, and we do well to remember that. I just said, for my part, just some of my influences. Pete Seeger, Woody Guthrie, Tom Paxton, Arlo Guthrie, Steve Goodman, Gene Shepard, Bill Cosby, Lily Tomlin, J.O. Callahan, Donald Davis, Willie Claflin, Kevin Kling, Len Cabral, Spalding Gray, Whoopi Goldberg, Bruce Springsteen, Michael Parent, Tony Montanaro, and Benny Reel, Utah Phillips, Rosalie Sorrells, Jackson Brown, Gamble Rogers, James Thurber, Carl Sandburg, Jorge Luis Borges, Del Close, Charna Halpern, Shel Silverstein, Roald Dahl, Duncan Williamson, Bessie Jones and Ben Botkin, and that's just for starts, because half of you here, too. So we're all mixed up. We're Mongols when we started, and we still are. And despite those of us who fear the other, Mongolization is actually a pretty good thing. Any good wildlife biologist will tell you that all the interesting stuff happens at the edges. The center is boring. So our mixing matches of different strains, and different approaches, and different kinds of story makes us unique and promising and hopeful and presents the possibility of something more. Any attempts at trying to be pure definitions is going to get us into trouble, which is why I'm going to give us some definitions right now. But this is just to set the stage, and it's just, because what I want to do is kind of go back and remind us of what we're really about here in this room, at least what I think, which is about one person talking for longer than 4 minutes in front of other people. You may do other things when you're there. You know, you may sing or hop or dance around or dress in a tutu or have a screen behind you showing the eruption of Vesuvius. But all this is window dressing. I remember a number of years ago seeing Laurie Anderson, who's just a great artist, but she had this huge thing, and it was like, you know, keyboards and all this stuff going on. But the best part of her show was when all that stuff went down and she told a story, because that's who she really is. Maybe Laurie Anderson's interested in that, and she thinks she needs all that, but it's all to get to the story. Storytelling by 4 minutes. What I mean by that is that you have to talk long enough to have there be a narrative thread. My sense is if you talk longer than 4 minutes, what you're saying has to go somewhere. It has to be a journey. I'm not saying stories can't be told in less than 4 minutes, but poems can be done in less than 4 minutes, and songs can be done in less than 4 minutes. It's about going somewhere. Storytelling, in the end, is about what happens next. It doesn't make any difference what the subtext is if people don't care what happens next. And so we have to light that fire. That's what storytelling is about. So talkers have to talk in narrative, unless you're a politician or a tenured professor. And it's not reading, it's talking. I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but I'm just trying to remind us so we go back to the beginning, because everything comes from this. There's nothing between the speaker and the listener, but the words are offered there in the air. And for the sake of being, for the time being, let's let out the disembodied voice. As important as radio is, and it's an important part of our work, as important as speaker words coming out of a speaker are important, that's still not what the central thing is. It's the person speaking with someone in front of them. So let's remember what this leaves out. It leaves out television and radio talk shows and movies and digital storytelling. Whatever that is. I mean, I kind of know, but I kind of don't want to know. PowerPoint presentations with the words on the screen that the person is just saying that the words are on the screen. I love those. Theater pieces with characters talking to each other. Instant messaging. Facebook posts. I'm not going to talk about any of those things except in derogatory fashion. I'm not saying they don't have a place. I'm just saying that's not what I'm talking about. For us to move forward, I think we have to keep this definition or something like it in front of us. When we get sidetracked, we're thinking that we can do our storytelling, that Facebook is the place for us to do storytelling, we're going to lose the power that we have, which is us right here. So let's get back to what happened to us. I'm not going to go over all this because we've been kind of going over all weekend, but I got a little, I was there too for most of it. All these different mongrel strains came together 35, 40 years ago. And it was kind of a perfect storm waiting to happen. The library world and the theater world and the world of oral tradition, and all these things just happened to come together. Early in my life as a storyteller, I wrote down that I viewed my work as an intimate response to an impersonal culture. And I will be quite honest with you and tell you that storytelling was all my idea. I know some of you feel like that yourselves. So then I came up with this idea. I didn't know that there were other people that called themselves storytellers. I hatched this plot. I was in Syracuse, New York, and I was with my wife, Debbie. We hadn't married yet, and we were living with each other, and she had a job. And I had this idea I was going to be a storyteller. And I actually knew two stories, but this was a new idea, and so it was understandable that I only had two stories. And I went to the Syracuse school system, and I proposed they hired me as a storyteller. And it was like I'd walked in and had three heads, and they said, that's a nice idea, and they let me out the door. And then I ran into a woman who said she was a storyteller, and she recited verbatim, Tiki Tiki Tembo. And I thought, that's good, but that's not exactly what I had in mind. I wanted something a little wilder. Now, unbeknownst to me at the time, there were already several hundred other people who had stolen my idea, even several years before I had it. Without speaking too much for them, my experience as I met them, or should I say you, was that everybody else was trying to do the same thing, which was give an intimate response to an impersonal culture. And here I will pause for a moment to note the traditional tellers who were working in their corners of the world, shaking their heads at our idiocy. We bow in their general direction, and it is a good practice for us to continue doing that. But something happened. You couldn't call an explosion. I kind of look at it as a bottle rocket, you know, popping on the cultural landscape. I moved to Providence. I found someone named Len Cabral, who was telling stories in preschools, and Marilyn Meerden, who was an actress who stood up on her own, and Mark Levitt was telling stories as part of the medicine show. It was this new vaudeville act, and Milbury Birch had just moved to Providence, and Lee Ellen Marvin was producing storytellers on public radio in Boston, Judith Black and Doug Lippman and Elizabeth Dunham, and I drove up to Marshfield, and I met this guy named Jay O'Callaghan, and I sat at his picnic table in his backyard, and I figured he was a millionaire because he had a house and kids, and he was on the radio, and he said, "Wonderful, go forth. Here's 6 feet of rope. It's just enough about to hang yourself." He didn't say that. And then I went to Jonesboro, and I watched Gamble and Gail and Elizabeth and Donald and Michael and Connie and Barbara and Laura in front of 500 people, and I said, "This is what I want to do." We can't escape Jonesboro, at least as part of our past. And in this fit of genius or hubris, Jimmy Neal Smith named it the National Storytelling Festival, and we responded. We needed a home, and it became our home by default. And in line with the folk aspects of storytelling, it seemed natural. There it was. You know, in Johnson City, the Carter family and Jimmy Rogers had recorded, and over the hill was the Hicks family. We were in Appalachia, and that seemed authentic to us because I think at the end, storytelling is about a search for an authentic voice. And we were hungry, and this looked like the thing to do. There were festivals sprouting up, and artists were getting paid hundreds of dollars. And we didn't worry about money at first because we wanted attention. And I didn't have any kids, and my wife had health insurance. We wanted an audience. And I'll tell you, there were grasping years. There was a lot of desperation and hunger in those years, but it was also very heady and very exciting. And we kind of blew it. It's only now that I can see we kind of blew it. And I say kind of because we didn't see it. And we had best intentions. And a lot of it was so good. And others this weekend have kind of outlined what happened. And I don't want to spend too much time on it, but it seems to me it was kind of only natural that we kind of blew it. And festivals are sprouting up. There seemed like there was more and more work for storytellers. But in the long run, and this is where we are now, the festival model has given us a narrow spectrum of what storytelling is and might be. Not all good storytelling belongs in a 1,000-seat tent. But I say this as someone who learned to perform in a 1,000-seat tent and got pretty good at it. But it doesn't mean I'm a better storyteller than someone who can't. It means I'm a better performer in a tent with 1,000 people, which is a good thing to be if you can find a tent with 1,000 people. I remember thinking this in 1986 when I saw Duncan Williamson at the National Festival, and he was performing in small tents. They still had some small tents at that time. And it's where Duncan belonged. I followed him around like a little puppy because I knew there was something there. He was not big in style, and while he was funny, he was not gut-spilling funny. Funniness had to do with a human condition. Humor had to do with a human condition. His skill had been learned around fires and kitchens and pubs, and was designed to be intimate. And there was another guy, I remember, Pete Boyer, a French-Canadian teller from Missouri who played fiddle. Pete was a real deal, but he died on the vine in Jonesboro. We've all seen that. By the end of the festival, there were 25 people coming to see him, because in that context, you couldn't see who he was. Catherine Windham stands out as the one person who seemed to have been able to make this transition, and I'm not sure why. She was craftier than she looked. I think we all know that. And she was telling in the South. Which leads me to another problem with the festival model. It's generally a conservative endeavor. And by that, I don't mean right-wing Republican, although there are elements of that. I mean that the audience just doesn't want its feathers ruffled too much. It is entertainment as a conserving activity, which is a fine thing in its place. The storytelling at festivals today is more about the affirmation of a particular world than it is a challenging of the world. It affirms your life and doesn't take you outside of it. David Booth has a great book, and for those of you who work in the schools, it's the Music Teaching Artist Bible, and he came out of the Lincoln Center. He says this incredible thing at the beginning. He says, entertainment affirms your world, and art takes you outside of it. Now, three people can be sitting in the same art event and have the same experience. For one, it's entertainment because it doesn't do anything different. For two, it opens their eyes in a way they can never see things before. And the third person thinks it's the most boring thing in the world. But generally, the storytelling in festivals is a conserving activity. It's entertainment. We knew that. Storytellers knew that. Storytellers are generally more progressive and adventurous than the audiences they're performing for. And audiences, the individuals in audiences, are more adventurous than the audience itself. Most of us would like to stir things up a little bit, but we're not stupid. Even if you're a rabble-rouser, you understand that you can only push an audience so far. Ed Stuyvesant's little monologue at Jonesboro, the fall before the Iraq War, got him pilloried. But he was only speaking the truth. We were marching blindly off to war. The audience didn't want to hear that. I sat at the stage, side of the stage, just as radical as the next guy. The next week, I marched in New York City with a million other people saying, this is a horrible idea. But I sat there and I thought, they're going to eat him alive. And they did, although it was more like a nibbling alive. And you know what? Ed apologized, and he probably shouldn't have had to do that. Actually, he shouldn't have had to. And then there's Laura. Laura curated the most broad-minded festival with tellers from around the world, but the audience wasn't ready for it. I look at what Laura did, and I think of a minister who knows what the truth is, but knows that they get too far ahead of the congregation. They show up, and the pews will be empty the next year. And as good a part of that, and a good part of that audience probably just wasn't ready for Spalding Gray's neuroticism, you know, New York neuroticism or whatever else. But Laura had a vision. And then sitting in a folding chair in 50-degree weather may not be the best way to hear someone's work, especially if you're a quarter mile away from them. So even as storytelling audiences grew, it seems to me storytelling's definition was being narrowed. We're not giving storytellers a chance to do their best work or to challenge themselves. Constrained by time limits, by light and sound capabilities, by the kinds of audiences festivals were drawing, some of us adapted to that model. I mean, I'm telling you, nothing like 1,500 people applauding and yelling. Nothing like it. Just nothing like it. It's a drug, and it's hard to give up. And I have a great amount of grief over what has happened. But it's not an empty form either. I'm not saying that. It's a great form, and there's art in it. And I won't say that I was selling myself out or that any of us were. I wasn't saying something that wasn't in my heart. I was just aware of where my heart and the audience and the setting might best meet. And that is a never-ending challenge for the artist. But the truth is, the model never translated really very well beyond two or three other places. And those successes have their own cultural backdrop to explain it. The Timpanogos Festival in Utah is a wonderful festival, but there are reasons that it's successful there. Most of these festivals were and are labors of love by individuals who have a vision and are trying to make it work. And it did, and it has on some level, but not on the level we had hoped. Hoping that if the festival were done right, those thousands would come to this place. But you know what? I don't think that was ever right. I'll go back to what I wrote to myself 30 years ago. Storytelling is an intimate response to an impersonal culture. That does not promise a storyteller could fill the Hollywood Bowl. It argues against it. So Jonesboro let storytellers down. And I don't want to get into the economics of it, but the truth is, at a certain point, the main thing the festival had to do was get people in the seats to support the organizations. That was its main job. That was its mission. And that is a sure way to lose a sense of a mission. And our failure, I guess, was in continuing to believe it was one thing when it was really something else. It was presented as the heart of storytelling when really it was just one expression of it. We made attempts at trying to change it. There are dozens of people in this room who have made attempts to try to change it. And as a matter of fact, some of us still are. Many storytellers served on the board and tried to right the ship. NSN split away from ISC, but they didn't let us down because of the kind of festival they ran. In the end, their job was to get people in the seats and not get people upset. But we kept thinking it was a national festival, and really at the present moment, it's a large southern regional festival, and Susan O'Connor is doing her best to do the best festival she can, given the parameters that are handed to her, without a vision of what they could or should be. No, where the Storytelling Center let us down was in saying it was a national festival when it wasn't. And in saying... And in saying it was the International Center for Storytelling when they weren't. It doesn't represent the face of America, its breadth or its depth. Many of us have known that for years, that the festival is really about Jonesboro. And it's always been the leadership's main interest. What was missing was a vision of what it means to be national. Forget the international. But we wanted a home. We had a home. We met there. We got together there every year. And the storytelling there is good. You don't get there unless you're good in a particular way. And the other big failing of the Storytelling Center, and for a long while, most of us, although this is being addressed here now, and I have so much appreciation, is that they were doing nothing to encourage others to see us as a true art form or to expand the boundary of storytelling beyond Jonesboro. Not that so millions would come. Not so that we can make millions of dollars, although I'm not opposed to it, but I'm seeing... But that so people who had an influence in the world and in culture could see our value and take storytelling as something worthwhile to be considered. But we hung on to festivals because they were so much fun. When individual storytellers tried to address issues of mission or diversity or pay, we got that famous smile and nod as if we were being considered. And in the end, we weren't. Maybe we should have stopped right there and organized. In fact, some of us tried, but it's just not that easy. Because as performing storytellers, those of us who are in the visible, we're trying to make a living, and it's not easy. Art will always be a crappy way to make a living. To make money. Artists, and the best book to read on that is Lewis Hyde's The Gift. It's the book. It is just the book. Art will always be a hustle. And I do believe, as Laura said the other day, my job, is to be as good as I can at my art. That is my first job. So for this and several other reasons, I think in the 90s we missed a critical moment to sustain storytelling as a significant cultural presence. I believe storytelling missed this moment that we might have had. We might have gotten the art and culture world's attention and been taken seriously as an art form that other forms need to pay attention to. We missed our moment because of what was going on in our community. And those who could have made a case for being taken seriously were doing other things. It's what happened. So we're more of a backwater than we think we should be. Great. We get to feel slighted just like the rest of the human race. But there are other forces at work, too, so I don't think we can beat ourselves up too much of this. Some of this is not our doing and has nothing to do with storytelling. In regards to make a living as a storyteller, the huge shifts in media and technology have affected us very deeply. We are some of the victims of the digital revolution. Entertainment has been redefined over the past 30 years, and live performance is not the form of entertainment many people now choose. When I was performing in the 90s doing family shows, I regularly had 300 or 400 or 500 people show up at my shows. And now I have 100 and 150. It's not because I got worse at it. I hope. Beyond that, being a storytelling audience is a hard work. It refers back to what Gay said the other night. Rewarding but not easy. It requires attention and concentration. Our world, with all its increased input and the chimera of the possibility of multitasking, works against the attention needed. Because it's easier to watch images than it is to listen to words. And storytellers are not spending thousands of hours a week, as Facebook and Google is, trying to figure out how to keep these people tuned in for just 5 minutes more, 5 minutes more, 5 minutes more. So we've lost market. We've lost audience in the marketplace. But more than that, these guys who designed the digital revolution, unsure of themselves to this day where it is headed, lied to us, and probably to themselves. These platforms promised us wider access to audience, but they didn't mention that their technology was what they were really promoting, not our content. They don't care about our content. Marshall McLuhan's edict that the medium is the message has never been truer than it is today. We spend more time chatting. Now, there is a value-laden term that has been handed to our communication. We spend more time chatting about storytelling today to people we barely know than we do to telling stories to the people in front of us. And the digital revolution's promise that we could sell more products, that's a lie, too. We sell less and less. Every year, my CD sales for the past 10 years have gone down by 10%. My product sales used to be over half of my income, and now it's 20%. And it's not because I'm making more as a performer. Okay. People who control the platform aren't interested in selling your stuff. Actually, they're interested in using your stuff to bring people to their platform. It might be that a million people will see your 7-minute YouTube performance, but this doesn't translate to income or to work, because tomorrow, guess what? There's going to be someone else's 7 minutes, and they will say, well, I remember that. But the internet discourages long-term memory, which is what we trade on. Utah Phillips said, there's nothing more radical in America than a long-term memory. Facebook and Google would like you to offer yourself for free. That's what they really want you to do, because they want those people. They promise you a wider audience. But here's another quote from Walter Lippmann, a social historian, after the quiz show scandals in the 60s, 50s and 60s. The devil doesn't come asking you to sell your soul. He comes offering a wider audience. And thanks to Google and Facebook and Napster and Amazon's deep discounting, another aspect of the evil mothership, people now believe that content should be free. The digital revolution is the death of content providers and the rise of platforms. How can an artist make a living if they can't sell what they produce? So the result of this shift in media and entertainment has had a serious effect on us, storytellers. Storytelling is not a lingua franca for young people. Live performance is not a lingua franca. YouTube is a lingua franca. Tweeting is a lingua franca. 30 years ago, there weren't a lot of us, but there were a good number of young, intelligent people who were exploring storytelling. Now we have some brilliant young people here even today, but not a large enough group of them in our community that interact with each other and influence each other in a meaningful way, I think. Correct me if I'm wrong. The other thing that we've suffered from is the destruction of the public person. We are not public creatures anymore. We are private. Actually, we're privatized. Facebook has more information about us than the government or your next-door neighbor. And much of the performing arts and a great deal of storytelling depends on public people and public funding. I, for one, believe this is the way it should be. We can do things together. We can't do apart. And just because an endeavor is not sustainable in the marketplace doesn't mean it shouldn't exist. This is one function of government, to support worthwhile things that the marketplace can't support. Maybe its most important function. And this country is in the process of turning away from that. Because we don't want to pay taxes, our public institutions are failing us, our schools are starving, and the first thing to suffer in a school budget is... Right. How many people in this room have seen a drop-off in their work in education? Do we believe that art is a commodity that can survive in the marketplace? Are we under the illusion that cutting taxes will increase the arts? We can't afford it, some say, if it can't pay its own way. As if everything is worth is measured in dollar signs. But we could support these things if we had the will and understood that those who promise a bright future, a digital future, where people can make millions of dollars as artists, are talking about a very small percentage of people, the 1%. So the changes in media and defunding and destruction of public institutions are large forces that are difficult for us to address. I mean, we can address them as a group and individuals, but they are really large. But, shoulda, woulda, coulda. In some ways, I don't think anything's different than it was 30 or 40 years ago. The things we're still concerned about are still our concerns today. We're still a rude and intimate response to an impersonal culture, even though the impersonal culture has learned to disguise itself as personal. Personal web pages, address books, news feeds, but an algorithm is not a personal thing. Corporations will never turn to storytelling and storytellers to make money. They may use us to tell their stories, but we are not marketable on a wide scale. We cannot be franchised or digitized or commodified or monetized on any great scale, and therefore, we in this room are economically irrelevant. How does that feel? But, there is so much to do. The first thing I want to do when we think about where we go is to remind ourselves again and again that storytelling is a small thing. I didn't say it's not important. I said it's small. I didn't say it can't have an impact. I said it's small. Let us be like Bill Lepp's wonderful character, the king of small things, in charge of buttons and zippers and pins that keep the world together. If we try to be big, we're going to get ourselves in trouble. Storytelling by its very nature is intimate and does not translate to large venues, nor TV very well. And while a platform may bring attention to our work, the work itself will stay centered in a small setting. I think that the success of The Moth on the radio and the TED Talks, the two most visible expressions of storytelling in our media, is that they capture to some effect those smaller settings in which someone has something to say. And let us try to remember that storytelling success does not depend on spreading word about the concept of storytelling. It's about the individuals who tell stories very well. This is a hard concept to grasp, but storytelling as a performance art cannot be promoted theoretically. It has to be promoted by the excellence of the individual teller. Our success will be merit-based, depending on our individual excellence. I would like to propose here that storytelling is a different kind of art, one that is a basis for other arts. It is a seminal art. I'm going to call it a seed art, one from which other arts spring. This is its strength and its weakness. It is absolutely essential to theater and fiction and narrative film and teaching and journalism, but it is not easily recognized on its own because it is so elemental. As a building block for these other arts, it is not capable of being spectacle. It cannot survive overreaching and pomp and pretense. Seed arts have their aficionados, us, but they will not, as a general rule, fill the Meadowlands Stadium. Bruce Springsteen, Telling a great story behind a band with a band of 10 people behind him will, but Bruce Springsteen himself sitting on the stage telling a story will not fill Meadowlands. I think we should spend some time thinking about what it means to be a seed art. When I think of other seed arts, I think of, for instance, drawing, the basis of all visual art, or some form of simple group dance in which the body first learns to move in an elegant way in accord with others. Seed arts don't garner large amounts of attention or money because they are not flashy and they lack in spectacle, but they are basic to human expression, the building block on which all other arts are built. And as storytellers, we understand the importance of nurturing them. The seed arts are something that artists of all stripes should come back to again and again for renewal. And people who teach the seed arts and demonstrate them in their own work are essential to the well-being of all art and all artists. Seed arts, it seems to me, are skills that have crossed over some barrier towards something else. They are skills that have gathered attention, which is what art is about, the gathering of attention. One person telling a story to someone else is not art. Or recounting an embarrassing experience to two other workmates while standing around the coffee pot. But when someone does something that other people are doing and it begins to attract attention, not because of voyeurism, but because of some talent, some resonance, then it seems to me we have crossed over into the world of art. And when this shift happens, it happens because an attention to form. Everyone doodles. What's the difference between doodling and sketching and drawing? Between a child's picture of a house and sun and clouds and Picasso's simple drawing of a hand holding flowers? It's attention to form. Or between flailing around a dance floor to a techno beat and a beginning swing dancer and river dance or one of Liz Lerman's community pieces? A skill that attracts attention through the introduction of form and structure. David Pye, was a British woodworker. He has this beautiful book about woodworking, but it's really about art, nature and art of workmanship. And he says, in a craft, in a workmanship, there are three things we must pay attention to. And this is a seed art thing. It's judgment, dexterity, and care. And if we think about our work, those are the things we need to pay attention to. The truth is, many other art forms would be enhanced by a deeper understanding of the seed art of storytelling. I just recently, last week, presented a workshop in Utah, a writing workshop for writers on the connection between the oral and the written word. And everybody who was in that workshop came out with this deeper understanding of what their voice was. So I'm just going to make a couple suggestions. I don't even know what time it is. How are we doing? Just fine. Wow. What time are we supposed to finish? All right. I haven't told any stories yet either. I kind of screwed up on that. Okay, I'm going to make some suggestions, but these are just my, like, half-assed suggestions, okay? That was not written. And some of these things are already happening, probably without my knowledge, or I know some of them, even from this weekend, I know that some things are. And to those of you who are going to say, I already know that, I'm doing it fine. This is an affirmation for your work. That's good. Like I said, I got my head buried in trying to figure out how to make the next buck as a storyteller. First, we have to work towards a deeper understanding of what storytelling is, what its characteristics are, and what points towards good storytelling. We need an honest and direct language. Now, there's a wide spectrum of good storytelling, and we can talk about this for a long time, but if storytelling is going to be taken seriously, we need to begin to have a vocabulary so we can talk about it, not in terms of whether I liked it or not, but what aspects point towards its excellence? Of course it's subjective, but arts can be discussed with some objectivity. Visual art has form and content and color and balance and design and composition. We can talk about a painting or a photograph intelligently, and we can understand on looking at a piece why it has value. Filmmakers have a way about speaking with each other. I've talked about this before in other places at Sharing the Fire, but we need to develop this language so we can talk among ourselves in order to do our work better. Understanding why something works or why it doesn't is a step towards excellence. we can certainly find an intelligent way to talk about the nature of story and story structure and the development of the human voice and a performer's relationship with the audience. In fact, we have to develop this openly and honestly if we're going to move forward, because I don't think we're good enough. I don't think we're good enough. We are not good enough yet. And I'm not going to start picking and choosing about who's good or who's bad. That's not the issue. But I truly believe if there were 300 storytellers in this country who could blow people away in the proper venue, we would have a critical mass of artists that would attract attention and legitimacy to this art form. One way to head towards this critical mass is to develop a critical language and find forms in which we can explore others' works. We are not challenging ourselves enough. Believe me, I need more work too. I know this. Few are exempt. My charge to you is to work on your skills, and this requires a certain fierceness and relentlessness and honesty. I'm still learning how to work. This should never end. Picasso said, when art critics get together, they talk about art. And when artists get together, they talk about turpentine. We need to talk about turpentine. To some extent, being called art is after the fact, because all we're doing is craft. That's someone else's decision about whether it's art or not. Our job is to be craftspeople as good as we can and hope that it approaches art. Here I'd like to say that I've come to realize being a good storyteller is really hard. It's a huge skill set. I believe that while everyone can tell a story, to approach excellence, one must have a very quick and active mind, a great breadth of knowledge, great command and love of language, a good understanding of narrative structure and timing, good physical tools, a command of voice and body, and a deep insight into the human condition. That's a pretty big skill set. And most of us are given or develop two or three of those. It's hard to do this. And then you have to figure out how to eat. We need to reach out and form alliances with like-minded folks. And a nod to NSN's work here. It's been really great to hear the stuff that everybody here is doing. But we are now addressing issues we should have addressed 20 years ago. We badly needed to place at the table with other art forms. And there are allies in the theater world and in the world of literature that are there if we make access to them. Mark Lutwak, who's right here at the Playhouse in the Park, is a very good example of this. They're out there, but we need to consciously develop those friends so that we have a place at the table. I think, and this is just spinning things out, we need several new or redesigned major spoken word festivals around this country. We need places where there's a critical mass of artists that can interact with each other and an interested public, perhaps working the festivals, working with each other in sharing of resources and ideas, a network of festivals maybe. I say festival rather than performance series because I'm thinking of a period of time in which artists are together and can interact. And I think in order to make them successful, we are going to have to broaden our definition to the spoken word notion. Make it a bigger tent. Making sure we bring the wisdom of the past 40 years to bear on the tone of these festivals, but also exploring other forms. We should do this so we can begin to have a conversation with other art forms. A spoken word festival should incorporate slam poetry and solo theater and musicians who contextualize their work by talking too much, and maybe even novelists and essays who read well. We could teach them a thing or two. It should include panels and talkbacks on the spoken word. Artists from other disciplines should somehow be incorporated. They should be in metropolitan centers where there is some intellectual ferment. And should include whatever form young people are gravitating towards. Because we now need to serve the young. This is the hardest point. But we as a group are too old to carry this movement to its next phase. As much as I would like to be on the cutting edge, I am not, and I probably never was, and if I was, I hope I had a good time when I was there. But we know, and we all know this, I'm saying and speaking to the choir, we need new voices, and will not be people who are over 50. We can be mentors and examples and encouragers and still very, very good performers continuing to grow, but we need to pass this mantle on to younger people who will try things we will never try, find venues we'd not thought of, and carry this tradition different from what we think they should do, and very much their own. In the past couple weeks thinking about this, I have been imagining something else, a school of storytelling. The school of storytelling would be weird and illegitimate. It would not be affiliated with the university that offered credit. Because the problem is there's a problem with the academy today, that people work towards certification of their talent. And a degree gives certification of time spent, does not give talent or excellence. We need a small, unaccredited school, say just starting a month long, with a half dozen teachers and only 25 students. The teachers need to be very accomplished in their craft, the very best we can find, learned in the shaping of story, the use of voice and body, the art of performance, the understanding of venue, the connection with the past and with the future. The teachers need to be very, very smart, as do the students. Students have to apply and are accepted for their promise or are approached and invited. The students wouldn't come to be as certified as official storytellers, but to learn their craft because they really, really want to and are recognized. And, okay, where I lost myself. Pretty good so far, though. They would leave with no degree but a deeper understanding of story and the performance of it. And maybe they wouldn't end up being storytellers. Maybe they would go into theater and film and education, but they would be grounded as storytellers, versed in this elemental seed art. And we can hope that some would say their job is to be a storyteller. Both students and faculty would benefit from this kind of laboratory. It needs to be a place of nurturance and growth, and the food needs to be good. And the last area I'm just going to talk about is, and it's a big talk, and I know everybody's thinking about it, it's a lot of people working here, is we need to make our case more forcefully for the role of storytelling as a teaching and learning tool. Both teachers and students need to understand the nature of storytelling, and I know that Sherry and Jane and Martha Hamilton and Mitch Weiss and Karen Chase and Judy Simmons, so many of you are working on this. But I think just as we need to establish context with leaders in other arts disciplines, we need to make connections with those on the forefront of learning and schooling, and I am not speaking of Arne Duncan or Bill Gates. Bill Gates' latest grant was handed out so that electric bracelets can be put on students so their galvanic response to teaching can be measured. Yeah. I mean people like Deborah Meyer and Diane Ravitch and the Coalition for Essential Schools and Alfie Cohn and Marianne Wolfe, whose book Proust and the Squid is brilliant about the brain and literacy. With every passing month, more and more research emerges on the nature of the human mind, and almost all of it points towards a deepening understanding about the role of spoken narrative in human life. We need to find a place at that table too. And I would be more explicit in my charge here. I believe that rather than showing how storytelling fits into this ever-narrowing definition of educational objectives and methods, storytellers should speak up for the rejection of these standards as any measure of good education. Put simply, the people who offer this kind of educational reform are not our friends, they are our enemies. And while we may have to work with the enemy, we should not agree to their worldview. Storytelling is not a reductionist program that teaches the 15 analytical strategies for understanding a text. And by trying to show how it is, we belittle our work and do a disservice to everyone. I believe that there is a strategy in this country to defund public education. And both political parties are participating, although one is far worse. And the only way this dismantling of the American educational system is going to happen, is stop, is when people involved start saying no and show there is another way. Storytelling is part of this way. And we must choose our battles. You have to work. But let's please be sure we choose them and not go along to get along. How many studies have we done that show arts are essential to learning? They don't care. Every time I say this to a group of educators, I get a standing ovation. What is stopping us? Yeah. I mean, you know, well, I won't go into it. These are some ideas, because I've gone on long enough. But there's also something about how we approach our work. I say to teachers that they get in trouble when they think that the structure of education is the superintendent and the principal and the vice principal and the teacher's aide. But really the structure of learning is the teacher that made you want to be a teacher and the teacher that made them want to be a teacher and the teacher that made them want to be a teacher and the person who you're teaching today who's going to want to be a teacher. And that structure is unbreakable and has been going on for 10,000 years. And this is true with us. Is it's the person that made us a storyteller and the person we want to make a storyteller. And it's also horizontal in the present day. It's the people around us that we go to for support and feedback. Whatever happens with the festival, our main job lies elsewhere, even for those of us considered their home. In fact, it has always lain elsewhere in the everyday work we do. But now let us do it with a clearer vision of where we want to go and some thought about how we might get there. The few suggestions I offer are just my ideas, and I plan on acting on some of them. But back to my earliest point, storytelling is made of storytellers, of individuals, and there are individuals here in this room that will help define the course of storytelling in the next 10 or 15 years. Do not wait for a leader. It is you. No one else will do the work that you do. Let us be conscious about what we are doing. Let us choose a thoughtful and heartfelt path and walk along it as best we know how, knowing that our work is important, personal, and intimate in a very wounded and confused and distracted world. I love you all. Thanks a lot. Sorry, I went over.